Today's episode is brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code, how to do graphic design, no matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to Lynda.com/crack today. That's LYNDA.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. This episode is also being brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your idea. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Running through the six with my woes. Count money, you know how it goes. Pray to real live forever, man. Pray to fakes get exposed. I want that Ferrari, then I swear. I want that Bugatti just to hurt. I ain't rock my jewelry, that's on purpose.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're talking about a bias in the movies and TV shows and music, just the popular culture that we consume in general, I guess, that it's so huge and pervasive and out of touch with reality that I'm shocked I hadn't noticed it before. Last week, I was reading an upcoming article by frequent guest of this podcast, Jason Parjim, writes on the site as David Wong, about how movies don't seem to understand what it's like to make under $200,000 a year, and how they seem to have a very specific agenda when it comes to portraying like poor characters and the class divide. And just like every point he made was, I don't know, you know that moment after a twist ending in a movie like Usual Suspects or The Sixth Sense where Bruce Willis or Sergeant Kuyan, I think, is like dumbly looking off into the middle distance and their entire working model of the universe is just collapsing all around them. And the director cuts back to all the moments earlier in the film that are like flashing through their mind that should have been clues about the twist that they're just realizing. Like, my wife stopped talking to me after I got shot in the stomach, and my wife isn't the worst person in the world. Of course I'm a ghost. The words Barbershop Quartet in Skokie, Illinois are written on my tack board, and he said he was in one of those. Of course he's a criminal mastermind. Anyways, I always thought that was just a cheap way for the director to like make us feel like the groundwork had been laid, but that actually happened to me as I was reading Jason's article. Every point he made, every example caused other examples and explanations to kind of flood into my head. Like, he brought up how Friends and Seinfeld and Broad City show characters who are poor, who live in huge apartments and have financial mishaps that don't end up having any consequences, and suddenly episodes of New Girl were flooding into my head, and we'll dig into that show a little bit. If you didn't read Jason's article, I recommend it, but if you did read it, don't worry, we're gonna kind of use it more as a jumping off point to discuss some questions it asks and some different theories that might answer some of those questions, mainly like, why is this bias there? The easy answer is that it's just easier or more fun to show a world where everyone is wealthy and has huge apartments. But I don't think that's completely it, because there are examples of poor characters on TV, and there have been periods in just general pop culture history where we would allow poor people to exist in squalor and worry about the financial consequences of their poverty. We'll briefly touch on serial killers, I think, in the context of True Detective, but what does it say that those are basically the only movie characters who are permitted to live in squalor with all their possessions looking like they came from some secondhand store? You know, the detectives who catch them have normal homes with nice clothes and furniture that it looks like they purchased at a store. And with True Detective, Matthew McConaughey's detective lives like he's poor in 1995. His apartment's mostly an empty shit heap. Then in 2012, he looks like his apartment, like a homeless guy who's spent the intervening 12 years smoking bug spray meth, I guess. And the show uses that to leave us on the fence about whether he might actually be the serial killer. Like, he could be the killer because he looks like one, in that he looks and lives like a poor person. So yeah, it's convenient, but I also feel like it's a central assumption of our pop culture that is forced in there, that says people who have nice shit are good and people in poverty are bad for the most part. If the point of the story is that the protagonist is poor, they'll live the lifestyle of usually an upper middle class person. Jason mentions a bunch of great examples in his article. The girl from The Wrong Side of the Tracks in Pretty in Pink lives in a spacious two-story home in the suburbs and has a working car at 16. I immediately thought of Two Broke Girls. The two girls in question live in an apartment in Williamsburg, one of the trendiest and most expensive neighborhoods in one of the most expensive cities in the world. One of the girls works two jobs, so that's realistic, but she has time to pursue her dream of launching a cupcake shop 5 years too late after that trend was over, but it's not her fault. She's on CBS. In reality, working two jobs means you have like 8 hours to eat and sleep, which means you probably have to eat fast food, which means that even if you have enough money to eat, you're still at risk of malnutrition, definitely at risk of being obese, and probably just exhausted like all the time. They face a few real struggles based on the Wikipedia episode summaries, like winter's approaching and they need to get a new pilot light. They solve those problems because the second broke girl is able to pawn her jewelry from her previous life as the daughter of one of the richest people in New York, who was disgraced Bernie Madoff style and is now in jail. But it's less the story of two broke girls than the story of the one actual poor girl who gets insanely lucky because she meets this dumb rich girl who doesn't realize she probably has millions of dollars in belongings that people will pay money for because, I don't know, she's very slow. Anyways, Jason points out that it's hard and narratively inconvenient to show realistic poor people, and that's sort of what I wanted to discuss, I guess. I don't think it's just an accident of story structure. I think the people who create our pop culture know they're playing to an audience that has lost touch with reality. There used to be a place to call bullshit on that sort of thing. We'll talk about periods in our pop culture when we were allowed to see gritty, realistic portraits of poor people. We'll mention the period during the late 70s when Rocky came out, and I don't think we mentioned other examples, but Saturday Night Fever shows a bunch of poor people living in accurately poor homes with their parents, and one kid jumps off a bridge because of his hopeless situation. And then we'll mention a period in the 90s that I was alive and storing memories for, when grunge was cool and Roseanne was on and the Wu-Tang Clan became famous, and great movies where money and poverty are a persistent problem came out around that time, like Boys in the Hood and Do the Right Thing, and popular ones like White Men Can't Jump. That's the main question I'm interested in. Is it just an accident of narrative structure and sort of wish fulfillment, or is it something bigger? Like, why haven't we had another one of those early 90s, late 70s reactions following the collapse of our economy and the fact that Americans are $11 trillion in debt to credit card companies? And look at what we're telling ourselves these days instead of gritty truths. And why it's terrifying. And I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Then Kanye dropped it, was polos and backpacks. Man, that was when Ethan was pushing the Subaru hatchback. Man, I'm talking way before hashtags. I was running through the six with my woes. Yeah. I was running through the six with my woes. You know how that shit go. All right, we are joined in studio / broom closet by Jason Pargin, aka David Wong, is in town. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
You said that you were thinking about just calling in from a desk somewhere in the office, just to keep it consistent. And to my left, Christy Harrison. How are you, Christy?
I'm good.
We had a little team get together out here in Los Angeles, and it's been a lot of fun.
It was a disciplinary hearing. Are we not are we not talking about what brought us out here? It's fine if you don't want to get into it. It's, I guess, yeah, it's an internal company matter, but
there are legal ramifications. And today we're going to be talking about, Jason, you wrote an article about fictional representations of people's problems with money that not having to do with money, which are the only kind that I was aware you were allowed to portray in pop culture. But you really kind of described a bunch of shows and movies that I had seen a number of times before and outlined this rule that I didn't realize existed that basically boils down to, like, you can't show actual poor people or the consequences of being poor.
Well, like a lot of the articles I write, this was born from a very deep flaw in my personality, in that going back to childhood, I can't watch a movie or TV show without thinking about how much money the characters make and like what they're driving and how they live. And it all goes back, I think, to when I was a kid and we were watching an episode of Married with Children, which was supposed to be about, you know, a dirt poor family that Al Bundy was a shoe salesman, I think it was.
The guy who fits you for your shoes. It's not like it was his shoe store.
It's clearly like a minimum wage job. And my dad, and I was just a kid at the time. It shows on in the 80s. But my dad noted that their house was far, far nicer than ours. They had like a second floor. And like they had done some basic set decoration to make it look dirty a little bit. But otherwise, it would have been like the nicest house in our neighborhood. And so from that day forward, I can't watch, especially if it's a show about like struggling or poor characters. And if I notice that they're living like way better than I was until very recently, I always notice it. So the thesis of the article was kind of that because of some things that aren't anybody's fault, there's certain limitations in how you shoot a show that requires them to have a certain amount of floor space. There's a reason why in the show Friends, they have these cavernous apartments. And a lot of it is just like, they're sort of just physical limitations on how you're shooting a show and how you're staging action. You need room for them to move around. But the overall result is that I think everybody I know goes out into the world out of high school or whatever with a completely skewed idea of what kind of a lifestyle a full-time job can afford you, a professional type job can afford you, or a customer service. Because on TV, wage slaves live like professionals and professionals live like millionaires. And that's just, you don't notice it until you really start paying attention to it. But I think you do notice it when you get out into the world and realize the type of apartment you can afford is like way worse than what you thought. And I think that's where that idea came from. It came from watching TV your whole life.
Yeah, you point out that the Family of Modern Family's house is $2.5 million. I mean, even the Seinfeld apartment, he's just a kind of a stand-up comedian who stays in New York. He doesn't like go on the road that much, and his apartment is, according to New York realtors, $900,000, which seems a little rich. And Kramer's presumably the same, and he's a guy who strings together odd jobs. New Girl was one that kept jumping into my mind as I was reading your description, because that's a show in which a elementary school teacher, a bartender who is constantly complaining about how poor he is, a guy who works in radio and then becomes a cop, and then a guy who works in marketing who lives with them because he lost a ton of money, apparently. Like, that's his backstory. They live in a giant, beautifully furnished apartment that they roller skate through, like, in a really cool neighborhood in Los Angeles.
It's Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's LA. But they're always flying to other cities. Like, one of them's dad is getting remarried, and they all go to the wedding and, like, buy new dresses. And, you know, for Thanksgiving, they decided to treat themselves to a vacation rather than go back to visit their family. I've never heard of someone like in their 20s or 30s deciding, no, I'm not going to spend money to go back and see my family. I'm going to spend money on a different vacation.
I know people like that.
Yeah, well, are they extremely wealthy?
No, but I do know that there are people who use credit cards in a way that's not...
They're just in a lot of debt.
Responsible. Yeah, so I feel like maybe these are those people. Maybe they've got credit lines and they're living it.
There are shows that will make jokes about that, like in Parks and Recreation, the low-level city employee, Tom
Haverford.
Like his whole thing is he lives this very blinged-out lifestyle that's beyond his means. But the point is kind of that they will make a joke about how he's got a lot of debt.
We know that's bad.
But the point is that they still couldn't design that character without, like, he lives like somebody makes $200,000 a year. And so, like, the show Sherlock, the BBC version with Benedict, the guy with the very British last name,
Cumberbatch.
Cumberbatch. In the first episode, like, the whole setup is that they have to move in together because of financial necessity. Right. Because Watson is, he's living, he's like on a disability, and then Sherlock Holmes doesn't understand the concept of money because of, he's too smart to understand.
Yeah.
So like they show, like he solves crime in his spare time, and just, you know, like he takes payments sometimes or gets deals, like there's a restaurant that gives him meals for free. But that 221 Baker Street apartment sold in real life for $2.8 million. And they have a plot point in the first episode where he like made a deal with the landlady because he had helped put her husband away for, he had been convicted of murder or something like that. So she owed him a favor, but I guarantee you she did not owe him so much of a favor that she gave him a $3 million property for free. Like, right. Even if she gave him half off on the rent, that's still a ludicrous amount of money because it's a big, spacious place in you know, right in the heart of London. And then when they dressed the two characters for the show, because at least one of them is a sex symbol, those cool silk shirts you see him wearing, those are in real life $300 to $500 shirts. His overcoat, if you buy it in real life, is $1,100. That jacket that Watson wears has like one patch on the shoulder. That's an $1,100 coat. So that's the thing. Is you could say, well, you know, maybe he had a case where he came into a bunch of money or whatever. But the point is, when they sat down to write the show, to come up with set design for the show, with costume design for the show, the idea of dressing these people as regular people or having them live like regular people was out of the question. Right. So if they have a backstory as to why he has the money, it's that every character on TV has that. Like on Friends, there was some joke about departments were rent controlled. Or in some other show, like Kramer on Seinfeld, they joke that he stumbled into an investment or something. But the point is that that's always the default. The people have mystery money so that they have an excuse to have them be a waitress during the day and make them seem relatable. And they can have life struggles we can relate to. But then when they come home, they've still got 2,000 square feet to mess around in. And it's, you know, a lot of room to film and a lot of room for them to have their adventures. And there's a big thing on this podcast we keep coming back to where we believe that pop culture influences the way people think in a lot of ways that are unexpected, because it kind of teaches you what to expect from the world. It's not so much in like lessons you learn, it's just you see how people live and you think this is the way people live. And so I feel for every one of like my classmates in college who wanted to move to New York for whatever industry, aspiring writers, right, or whatever, and thought, well, you know, I'll just have to go out there and get a job waiting tables or something, but I can live in a small apartment, it's fine, you know, like something 800 square feet, you know, I can get by, I don't need much. It's like you are still underestimating what your waiter salary is going to buy you out there.
And yet there are people that do it. I mean, there are people that move to New York right out of college and to LA right out of high school or college, and they manage. So it's not
They're check to check, though. I mean, like,
aren't we all?
There's ways they make it work. They make it work with roommates.
Yeah.
They make it work with very bad neighborhoods. They make it work with a refrigerator that doesn't open all the way because your bed is there.
Oh, okay. And your toilet's beside your bed.
And that's not, again, this is not a conspiracy by realtors in New York to try to trick people into moving there. It's just you can't shoot a TV show in that apartment
in
400 square feet. Like, that can't be done. There's no place to stage action. There's no place to put the equipment.
I do think it's actually just, even when they bring up that idea of there being a financial problem, they will eventually just move past it. And there's like sort of a gravitational pull of being rich. Like, we just want to see rich characters, essentially. The movie Big starts out with him being really poor in like a scary motel. His first paycheck is like $300 something, and there's like a joke where he's like $357, and John Lovett's like, yeah, it sucks, right? And then he goes and spends that paycheck on like Cheese Whiz and skateboards. But then he gets one promotion and buys an apartment that realtors say costs $2.3 million after a single promotion. And it's not treated as flagrantly irresponsible. Like, there's no epilogue. At the end of the movie, you're not supposed to be worried that the IRS is going to, like, once he grows into Tom Hanks, going to be like, oh, you owe us, like, millions of dollars. Like, you are so screwed, man. You just sort of accept it. Oh, he got a promotion. So now he's head toy tester. Those must make $5 million every paycheck. The movie Big Daddy is another example where it's like about a guy who's like doesn't have a lot of career ambition, but the way they explain it away is that he got a $200,000 settlement in a car accident. He's living in a, I think they said it's $6,000 a month, the rent for the place that he lives in, and works as a toll booth collector. And the premise of the movie is that he has been doing this for years, and like all his friends have built careers. It's like, man, this guy's in like a lot of trouble. It doesn't matter if he like learns responsibility with this kid. He's still like kind of fucked. So $6,000 a month, that would be, he's almost all the way through his settlement after probably a year and a half.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially if you factor in taxes you can take out of that settlement.
Yeah, that kid will not. That kid is going to starve to death. Like,
well, and in Big.
Adorably.
In Big, I think there's some deleted scenes where they, because remember, they fake a kidnapping. So right. I think they extort a lot of money out of his parents.
Oh.
and ruin them financially. That's how he furnished that apartment. But.
Well, yeah. I mean, trampolines and Cheese Whiz keep their value really well, so he can always just pawn those back.
But I think the draw isn't that we want to see wealthy characters, it's that we don't want money to have to be a factor at all. We want them to briefly mention it, and that's the thing that I think most people enter the world not realizing, is that the type of job you have to have so they don't really have to worry about money, those are rare jobs, and you have to like kill a man to get one. Like, that's not something like
what's
the rest
job
of us
that you're talking about. The
rest of us are you know, in a situation where if, you know, if your car breaks down, you lose the fun thing, the concert you were going to go to next month. Like, it's the margin for error. And so, like in a TV show, they may build in a money limitation into a plot, like somebody loses a bunch of money on a wacky scheme. But for the rest of us, that's like a rare thing that enters into our lives. The rest of us, every day, you have to think about money. Every day, you have to think about when you're getting groceries, what you can buy and what you can't buy. And that's what they don't, fictional characters don't have to do. And that's a luxury that most of us would kill for.
Yeah, I was trying to think of like places where you're allowed to be poor. And I came up with cautionary tales about athletes or MC Hammer, like rappers and athletes. We like stories where they go broke. We let Fox characters, like characters on Fox comedies, be poor for like, I think, maybe a season. But then like the consequences of being poor goes away.
Southerners.
And I think like overweight people from the Midwest. I haven't seen Mike and Molly, but I think they're supposed to be like blue collar. And
her Southerners. Point about the Southerners is interesting.
Well, I mean, like any movies that take place in the South or Appalachia, it's like, immediately, you know, it's rough there. Mm-hmm. And it's like part of the storyline. It's all about how poor they are.
Well, and they're like mutants.
Yeah.
Like they're used as like zombies in a lot of plot lines because of like they're so poor they're not human anymore.
Coal miner's daughter. That's not true. There are lots of humanizing, but you just take it. What's the movie with Jennifer Lawrence? Did you guys see that one where it's not Hunger Games? It's another
movie. Yeah, Winter's Bone.
Winter's Bone, and it's very poor, and it's just like she has to borrow food from her neighbor to make a soup for her siblings, and it looked real, and it looked like that's how people live, but it wasn't.
Drug addicts like that. That was the consequence of meth.
Drug addicts can be poor. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Southern drug addicts can be super poor.
Yeah.
But the Wire, they look poor.
Yeah.
But they're not, right? Like, they got cash.
But I think the point is that they become almost cartoon characters. Like, their entire life is, I'm a poor person in the same way that, I don't know, like in Lord of the Rings, like they're the hobbits. You're this weird species of trailer trash, or they're like in horror movies now, there's the trope of, you know, the subhuman, like inbred white trash that are very violent, or what, like in Deliverance, or
the bad guy in True Detective.
Okay, yeah.
He has a huge house, though, but it's like a plantation, I'm assuming, right?
And because of he's so poor, like all of his values are completely skewed. He's basically not a human being anymore. It's something so alien and scary where, again, the rest of us all feel poor when we're doing certain things. Like, money is a limitation for everybody, but in movies, like, it's only a specific plot point, whereas the rest of it's an everyday thing. So the fact that they treat poverty, when they portray it realistically, like, the whole movie has to be about that and what a living hell this is. Whereas half my friends are just, this is just every day.
So you can't have a poor Jennifer Lawrence just, you know, hanging out.
And that's not what it's about.
It's about trying to survive.
Because what it becomes about is limitations. And like I mentioned in the article, and you alluded to earlier, like the way people can just pick up and travel, like in a TV show, if they decide to do a Vegas episode,
yeah,
they're in Vegas. They're just, mm-hmm, you cut to them in Vegas. Now, there may be a plot point about them losing a bunch of money at the casino, at the roulette wheel, and then they've got to get it back or whatever. It just like in The Hangover, they talk about, you know, losing the money and owing the gangster money or having to get money back to get their friend back or whatever. But all of the incidental costs they build up along the way, trashing the car, an emergency room visit, trashing the hotel room, you know, having to eat out those extra days, like all of these other costs are just never mentioned. And somebody did the math and calculated they owed like $60,000 from that trip.
Just from that one night.
Just from that one crazy weekend or those two nights or whatever. Because
that seems low to me, almost. Like,
well, I think they're accounting for the money they won. They're saying like even Zach Galifianakis won at the table, it doesn't make a dent in what they still owe. So like they're still deeply in trouble.
Yeah, and that movie starts out with Bradley Cooper as, once again, elementary school teachers are apparently killing it these days. Yeah. He's an elementary school teacher who's like, I think he's having to like steal money from somebody.
From his children. Money for a field trip that he takes to Vegas to fund his.
Right. So he has a problem, presumably. Like that's fucked up. Like that guy would be on the front page of the local paper the next day if people found out about that. He's like in desperate need of money, but that just like goes away.
Right, and like Zach Galifianakis' character is like unemployable. I don't know what they portray him as doing as a job. And then Ed Helms is a dentist, mm-hmm, but makes a point of the fact that he can't afford the room they're staying in. Like he tells them it takes his entire savings and they're like, well, we'll deal with it later.
Well, he's financially responsible and that's portrayed as being just like a fucking wet blanket. Like, okay, dentist. So boring.
So anyway, there's a lot of ways they could deal with that. Like, you know, I think the guy who's missing, is it Doug? Whatever. Like, his family has money, but the issue is that nobody's worried about it. Yeah, like, right, at the end of the movie, it's like, everything's fine. We found him. He was on the roof. It's spoiler. It's everything's fine. It's like, yeah, maybe they will have to go and ask for a $50,000 loan from their friend's family, which would be like a horrible thing to have to do. But in the world of sitcoms, it's the same thing with like, you know, The Simpsons. Well, their house will explode and the next week it's just back again. And that's fine. That it's a cartoon. Yeah. But almost financially, everybody lives by that cartoon logic. Like, there's no matter what you do, whether you're all going to Jamaica for somebody's wedding or whatever, like nothing has any lasting consequences because it's just more convenient storytelling wise to ignore it.
Yeah. Their big question at the end of The Hangover Adventure is like, how are we going to get our awesome tuxedos on in time to get back for our crazy expensive wedding? I think there really is something with equating belongings and like having nice stuff to your value as a person. A bad guy will have just real shitty stuff in his apartment. Like when they like kick down the door, it's like, this place is filthy. What was he, poor? Did he not have rich parents? I feel like every character, you can just explain every fictional character by being like, oh, their parents are billionaires. And that's the only way it really makes sense. I do wonder if it's always been the case, because the late 70s, like we were allowed to show Rocky be actually poor. And then the 80s came along and everyone got rich, including Rocky. Rocky got smarter and richer and got robot butlers.
It should have gone like the smarter part shouldn't have happened. Didn't he like have brain damage and did?
I think he got speech
therapy is what happened.
And yeah, he got intelligence punched into his head over the course of his boxing career
while having like speech therapy, because he could definitely talk better later in his career.
Yeah, this
do his endorsements.
There's a scene at the start of the second movie where he can't do a commercial because he's so stupid. And
it's not intelligence. Yeah. I think it's literacy. I think he's just kind of illiterate. Did you guys know in the new Annie she's illiterate?
Oh, really?
Weird.
I didn't see that because spoiler, that looked like a bummer.
Well, I didn't mind the movie itself, but then she's like, I can't read. And I thought that was a low blow. Annie didn't need, and she's already an orphan. You don't need to take away her ability to read.
I thought her thing was that she was like always a little precocious and like kind of.
Oh, she's spunky. Yeah. Super spunky.
But just can't read.
Can't read. Yeah. I think in the 70s, there were lots of realistic portrayals, like Sanford and Son. And
yeah.
Were there white people who lived in poor settings in the 70s besides Rocky?
I guess I'm remembering Sanford and Son's home as being nicer than what it
can. There's a junkyard.
Can someone Google what the Sanford and Son's property looked like? I guess if they were, I guess they could have, they're running the business. I guess they could have done well with that. Anyway, yeah. As far as the trends go, we've talked before that there was a certain point on TV where like everyone had to be attractive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a little bit the same thing where like the set decorators are like, if it's not a rich person's place, it's got to look cool, it's got to be stylish, it's got to have a look to
it.
It's
their art. They're trying to present a good picture.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with the
audience.
With the costumers dressing, you know, Holmes and Watson. It's like they're thinking of, we'll make these two guys look super, super cool. And the fact that the stuff they're grabbing off the rack is a $500 shirt, that doesn't enter into the equation.
Right.
That's fine, but it's still, you walk away from that thinking, well, I can do odd jobs in my spare time. I can become a crime fighter in my spare time and not take money from people and then look cool. I can have all of those things. The grooming, the dress, the apartment, I can have all those things because the bar is set so low in the world of fiction for how much money you need to have in order to live a decent lifestyle.
Did the grunge movement in the early 90s, I feel like the only thing I can think of on TV or in movies, Reality Bites, mm-hmm. kind of like they were somewhat poor and that was seen as cool and being rich was seen as lame.
But they were also in Houston, so it wasn't New York, so it was a different kind of poor. They had a nice, decent-sized apartment for three or four of them. And
like Fisher King was a movie in the late 80s that was about a homeless guy that wasn't just like repulsed by him transparently. And then on TV you had Roseanne, late 80s to the mid 90s, and then the last season she won the lottery, but it might have been a dream. I don't remember how that ended.
That was a perfectly decent house too. Absolutely.
But they weren't portrayed as being unemployed or whatever. They were blue collar. And I think Malcolm in the Middle, the same thing. Money's constantly an issue because they've got the three kids and all that.
Right.
But you know, the father works, you know, and he's portrayed as having a decent job.
In Roseanne, Dan owned a hardware store that got shut down and like he was unemployed.
We're both right.
That was a great show, actually.
It was a good show.
No, and these are some of the good examples. Malcolm in the Middle routinely made that part of the plot line. Like, we can't do this because of the money. We can't
make
the trip because of the money. Like, the whole thing was sending the kid off to military school and the financial pressure. Like, they built that into the plot.
Right.
But if the show isn't about that, then money limitation just won't come into it at all. That's the thing. Is it like, because Sherlock is not about a couple of guys trying to make it in London and is instead about a genius solving crimes, then, again, same deal. If they need to solve a crime in France, they will just show them arriving in France. Like, however they get there is not, that's just not going to be addressed because that's not, they know that's not what we're watching for. And that's fine. It makes perfect sense from their point of view. But my whole thesis has always been that most of the messages you take home from pop culture were sent on accident. I think most of the things that get reinforced, negative things, there's nobody doing it on purpose. They're not bad people. It's just that they know we don't want to hear people complaining about paying bills, and so they just don't write it into the show. But I've got to say, I don't know anybody who got out of college with an accurate idea of what kind of lifestyle they could expect. I don't. Even the guys that made good money out of school, like some of them got in trouble because you don't have any kind of a sense of, like there's so many shows that are about struggling 20-somethings. And in the world of TV, you can only sink so far. And so the struggling 20-somethings, small apartment, multiple people to an apartment, you know, maybe it makes a joke out of how crappy their car is. They've got some off-brand car, How I Met Your Mother. I think they got like a Pontiac Fiero or something they would always joke about. But beyond that, no matter what goes wrong in their lives, no matter what medical bills come up off screen, you know, somebody has to go to the hospital, somebody else has a baby, and they'll never talk about the fees, the copays for that. You know, when they do the episode in Vegas, they'll just be in Vegas. They'll never talk about the cost, how they fit the cost of that $2,000 plane ticket into their budget. And it's just understood that this is as bad as it can get. The goofy guys on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia with the bar that doesn't make any money, like, they're all a bunch of losers, but they're never going to lose that bar. They're never going to lose their apartments. They're never going to lose their cars to a bill collector or to getting repossessed. Where the rest of us, yeah, there's like no limit how far you can fall.
Does anybody ever move back home and on TV ever.
Right.
I mean, it seems like that's a plot point. Like, that's something that's funny that you would do. You would set up a comedy with multiple generations.
Yeah.
I wouldn't watch it. That's not funny at all.
The Chris Elliott show, I think he was a paperboy who still lived with his parents, but that was the point. It's like, right. This guy is The Biggest Loser. Also a very funny show.
Whereas in real life, I think everyone sitting at this table knows somebody that's had to move back home. Yeah. It's the person I'm thinking of, I think they were 28, and I know another person who was around that age.
And no, that's if you're lucky.
They were
that's
30.
That's if you've got a home, if you can go.
The other person was having to go back to school, and that was the only way they could make it work, was by moving back home, and then the school was near where their parents lived, and the parents took them back in. Like, in real life, this is just one of the strategies you have to do to get back on your feet. And then we're in a TV show that's like hilarious, like a hilarious, wacky misunderstanding that you're living with mom and dad. It's like, no, this is like an everyday reality.
I know you're just saying it's nobody's fault that nobody comes out of high school or college with a good expectation of what your lifestyle should be. I feel like, that's parenting. You should be able to look around and say, okay, this is what life is like.
But they're
have magic powers like I see on TV. I should be able to see around me and expect that this is what the world is like.
That's true, but I think that, to Jason's point, the sense that I've gotten in publishing articles on Cracked and seeing what resonates with people is that so much of people's idea of reality is informed by TV and movies, and I'm sure their parents' idea of reality is too, so they're super concerned about educating their kid about like credit and, you know, the fact that Russell Simmons's credit card is going to like put you in debt for the rest of your life.
Well, there's a separate issue too. As a kid, by the time you're old enough to really look around and see how you're living, how the money works and all that, so, like, register how often you go out to eat, how often you do or don't take a vacation, you're usually 15, 16, 17 years old. Your parents are somewhere in their 40s. They're in a more established place in their lives. Like, your kids didn't see you when you were 21 or how you were living back then. They weren't there for that. So you could...
Actually, they were, but... they were infants, but that is true.
Yeah, they weren't learning. It's true. Infants are incredibly stupid. So they weren't absorbing any... They weren't there to... Like, you can sit there and talk to them all you want. Yeah. Like, well, I'll tell you right now, when I was your age, we weren't going out to the movies every weekend, and it just bounces off the head because their idea of life is how you're living.
And most people have their children older and they wait till they have money, and so a lot of kids come into the world just middle class.
The one example they've got is of their parents after 20 years of establishing themselves, you know, advancing in their careers, accumulating whatever, buying a house. Like, it's easy to think that when you come out into the world, you're going to pick up right where they already are.
And that was the trajectory for generations. For lots of people.
For a generation. But, you know, my parents' parents grew up in the Depression. And so they saw their parents, and their parents were scarred by that and, like, had a very specific mindset because that's when they came up. So
they were frugal.
Yeah, frugal and, like, didn't think about putting money into the stock market.
Or into banks. My grandmother would not trust banks.
Or she building kept her, wealth. Yeah, that
kept
was...
Kept her money in a refrigerator.
Yeah.
Because so the burglars wouldn't think to look there. She had it in a package, like a meat package. Like, because banks were this crazy, unstable thing. It didn't matter that it had been 60 years ago. It's like, once you've been burned, like, nope.
You're good. Pray for you. I got girls in real life trying to
f*** up my day. Going online, that ain't part of my day. Hey guys, I want to interrupt this episode real quick to tell you about our friends at Loot Crate. According to our friends at Science, you enjoy an item more if it's a surprise. So why buy anything for yourself? Wouldn't it be cooler if you had this friend who just went around comic book and gaming stores and came back with a bunch of cool shit for you every month? Loot Crate is that friend. Except you pay them, but like Bronn says on Game of Thrones, that enhances the friendship, if anything. For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items like vinyl figurines, comics, and shirts, and each month's box has a different theme. For example, February's theme was about playing together, so it celebrated fun stuff like pen and paper RPGs and board games. They'll even have exclusive items so you won't be able to get it from anywhere else, like a Funko Pop vinyl figure that was a fusion of Batman and Joker. And there were some Groot socks that you couldn't get anywhere else, I think, and pretty sweet pack of Tetris stickers. So go to lootcrate.com/cracked and take a look at some of the cool stuff you can get. And after you're thoroughly impressed, use promo code CRACKED and get $3 off of any new subscription. That's lootcrate.com and promo code CRACKED. If there's anything that blue and black slash white and gold dress taught us on Twitter the other day, and it wasn't much, but if it taught us anything, it's that even something completely stupid can reach millions of people and apparently make them lose their collective minds within minutes on the internet. And if you want to reach any large numbers of people, you got to use the internet. It's easy. It's like cheating, you guys. But building a website is hard, man. It involves math and stuff. Even if you know your way around code, creating something that looks good and works well is just crazy time consuming. Lucky for us, Squarespace provides simple templates for you to work with. And those templates are part of Squarespace's responsive design, which means your website, unlike that stupid dress, will look the same on any device. Their cover page feature even allows you to set up a beautiful one-page online presence in minutes. Squarespace gives you 24/7 online support and a beautiful website for only $8 a month, and you can even get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the whole year. You can start a free trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. Then enter offer code CRACK to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the Cracked podcast. That's something that we say a lot, but it really does help us if you use the Cracked offer code and try some of these products out, even if you don't end up buying them. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Call your ass a Uber, I got somewhere to be. I hear fairy tales about how they gonna run up on me. But run up when you see me, then we gon' see. I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Got a lot of people trying to drain me of this energy. Trying to take away from it. With the kid and pray for you. The thing that I'm still trying to, like, come up with the right answer on is whether it's a natural gravitational pull of, like, Rocky is always going to get richer, and then when he gets suddenly poor, we're going to stop watching until he gets rich again. And I think in that episode of Parks and Recreation, Tom puts himself in $2 million of debt, but when they, like, flash forward 3 years, he's trying to open a restaurant and he's, you know, has all these great prospects. It's not about how he now drives a Honda Accord from like 1992 and has to really struggle just to get by. It's about how he's opening a restaurant and what's his friend's name?
John. The lady.
He still has treat yourself days, yeah. where they go shopping, which again, still like flagrantly irresponsible. That guy's in so much debt, but you never see that. I do want to talk about reality TV. Because I was listening to this podcast where the mind behind Vanderpump Rules, the guy who like produces that show, was being interviewed by the two reality kind of experts at Grantland. And one of the issues that he brought up was that this show, Vanderpump Rules, is about one of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills has a restaurant. And she noticed that there was this group of like young aspiring actors who were waiters and bartenders at her restaurant who were great friends who loved to, you know, get in fights and have sex with each other's significant others, but would always make up. And so she started a reality show about that. And he was talking about how it has the highest ratings of any Bravo reality TV show, I think. And so the cast was like, all right, we want to get paid like all the other reality shows that you guys have. And he was like, no, the point is that you're young and struggling. If we pay you, like, that ruins the show. And that was news to me because I'm old. And I guess I stopped paying attention to whether anyone got paid after the second reality show, which was The Real World. The first was Cops. And both of those, you got the sense that they were almost being like, okay, this is where we show actual reality. Like, you're going to see poor people getting arrested, behaving badly, doing desperate things on Cops. And The Real World was like, you know, they're going to get a nice apartment, but they're not going to get paid. And like, that was specifically like set out.
They're like, excited about the apartment. Like, right. They're there for the apartment.
We'll put food in your refrigerator. But since then, apparently, like, all these reality shows, like The Hills on MTV, the girls who like started in high school, it was a reality show about just like good looking friends in high school. They were making millions of dollars by the end, but totally not acknowledging that. They made a conscious decision to never show that these people were famous, rich celebrities by the end of the show. and they still called themselves reality TV. And the Jersey Shore, the second season, after they were like some of the most famous people in America, they still went back to that same beach and lived in a shitty house. But they were all like millionaires at that point, but they chose not to acknowledge it. And so I don't know if that's the gravitational pull of, oh, this is more fun if we just like throw money and alcohol at it.
These are lifestyle shit. Like, these are supposed to show you, they are intended to show you what rich people look like and how they live. And I think that these are meant to be a fantasy.
But even the shows that aren't about that, like on the Discovery Channel, they have the show about the crab fishermen called The Deadliest Catch. And the whole driving force behind each season is they've got this very narrow window to catch a certain amount of crab. And because the fishing season's very short due to, it's like the crabs' migration patterns and their breeding grounds. So you have all these people who own their own fishing boats. And if they don't catch enough crab, they go broke. So that's why they're out there in these terrible storms and these blizzards sometimes. And that's why it's the deadliest catch. Is because people die doing that because that's how they make their money.
Right.
Well, now we're like 10 years into that show. All of the stars, all of the captains of those boats are now world famous. And they all have like websites where they sell merchandise for their boats and they do public speaking appearances. Like, they now clearly make the bulk of their income from the reality show. So right. Everything they say about, well, gosh, you know, if this is a bad season, I'm going to have to sell the boat and go live in an alley. Like, it ruins the dramatic tension. But you can't, the show's making money hand over fist. The Discovery Channel can't just keep the money. Like, they have negotiating power and say, look, you can go find a different bunch of boat captains, but we're the ones they're familiar with. We're who the fans come to see. Right. And so they can demand a paycheck.
We're going to A&E.
But that's still, again, this is nobody's fault. Nobody's right. trying to trick us. It's just the mechanics of how the show works creates a reality that makes it almost impossible.
I think they are trying to trick us. Like Duck Dynasty, that family makes $250,000 an episode. And the point of that show is like, look at these backwoods hicks who like have to eat varmint for...
Oh, that's not the point of the show.
Oh, okay. I guess
it's look at these guys you like that you want to be like and they just happen to be rich.
Jersey Shore. The point of that show was absolutely that these are idiots yes. who like come from neighborhoods where you still only hang out with other Italians, like that sort of background, and they're millionaires, but they won't show that, and they call it a reality show.
Duck Dynasty, I mean, I realize this, you were wrong to bring it up as an example, but that's a sitcom. They have scripts, they do table reads before episodes, and then they simply portray it as a reality show. The conversations, the jokes, they workshop that stuff ahead of time. They have writers in that show, but they don't pretend they're poor. Like, it's not necessarily...
Do you think that most of the fans of that show realize that? I guess would be my...
I don't know. And I don't know if they...
Well, no.
It blurs the line. Yeah, the show that's we're seeing here generated $400 million in revenue.
So my point is that a bunch of those are lifestyle shows, but after the first two reality mm-hmm. shows where the idea was we're going to show you reality, they haven't made another show where that's the point.
Reality's boring.
Well, yeah, but I guess reality's boring to us as a culture, but like Italy's great film is The Bicycle Thief, about a guy whose like life falls apart because his bicycle is stolen and he can't make any money off of it. And I do think it might be something specific to our place and time more than we might realize. And like, yeah, Rocky, obviously you could never get that movie made today, but that was a national phenomenon.
Well, like one of the points I made in the article is that even movies that take place in like a post-apocalyptic future, right. they have nicer apartments than what, like even when they're trying to horrify you with how the people are living,
right.
like in The Matrix when they're in Zion or in Dread, they're in this mega city of a future in which the earth has been destroyed by a nuclear war. And then Dread has to go invade the worst of the worst slums. And it's like these neat 800 square feet apartments with a lot of cabinets. Like the fridge is a little bit smaller than what you'd like, but there's like magnets on the fridge where the kids have, the walls are painted and there's no, and it's like, this is the worst. It's like the set decorator, like, okay, we want you to think up the worst thing you can come up with. And it's like in Elysium, Matt Damon lives on an earth that has been ruined, like utterly ruined. And he lives in this house and there's just a lot of junk laying around.
They just do darker versions of their own apartments. Like the yeah. writers, I imagine a Hollywood writer probably lives somewhere like that because you don't yeah, make a lot
if,
of money.
Like if
it's
if,
like his house.
If you spent one afternoon cleaning up his place in Elysium, you could sell that in Nashville for $300,000. Like, it's, it looks like it's about, like, 2,000 square feet, you know, like a big spacious kitchen dining room area. Like, it's a mess. It's a total mess. And, like, the doors hanging off as hinges or whatever.
High ceilings, though. I'm looking at the picture.
But it's, yeah, but otherwise, it's, like, so superficial. And the people, like, they can't conceive of, that's science fiction. Right now, on this earth, there are people, there are people living in, like, corrugated metal shanty towns. Yeah. Like, this is how, like, half the people on earth live. Like, they would live in that with six other people on the floor. And this is not in the far reaches of the earth. This is right. in America. My wife works with these families. Like, there are people where you've got six people living in, you know, a one bedroom, not referring to the crack staff that lives there. We could bring them in to talk. I think they choose to live like that. Okay. But that's the thing, is when they try to stretch their imagination, like, what's the poorest a person can possibly be? It's like, I could take you to parts of America, yeah. Appalachia and in Detroit, and show you how people are living. I had friends who lived in freaking abandoned trailers that there wasn't anybody there during the winter, but they knew nobody was checking them, so they lived there for a while. Like, there's people squatting, and it's, this is not a crazy, all that happens is they lost their job. That's it. That's,
yeah. I mean, my dad was one of eight in inner city Philadelphia on a cop's salary, and they all had to use the same bath water, and it sounded really gross. And, you know, he has just crazy stories about his childhood that I've never seen on TV or in movies. You'd never see anything like that unless it was like documentary footage.
I like how this Matrix picture, it's like almost chic. Like, it's not even, it's almost like people would decorate their house. Gray's very chic now.
Even not in the future, like Fight Club is specifically like a movie about society and about basically saying what I was saying earlier about how we define people's personalities by like
what they own.
They have a monologue where he's like saying, I am my IKEA, whatever, you know, he's not like Robert De Niro's character in Heat. He's proud to have all these things, and then he like snaps and goes and lives in abject poverty in this, as you pointed out in your article, an enormous Victorian house that's like, yeah, it's rotting, but it's like a mansion. And
yeah, that looks scary. That's the scariest building on this to me. I bet that stinks on the inside. He's got cool clothes.
His alter ego.
There's not running water in that building, is there?
They had running water. They had electricity too. And they make like a joke about it, like the fuse box would blow if you plugged in too many things, and it's like the water was dirty. It's like, man, I know people that lived without electricity, and I know people in my own life. I know people who, you get a leak in your roof, and they have like a blue tarp up there, and it's been like that for 2 years because that's a freaking $2,000 repair job.
Right.
Their home insurance won't pay for it. They can't get a loan. I didn't find this on like a tour of Africa. These are people I know. It's just, you visit their house. It's just the way it is. It's going to be like that until they fall into some amount of money. They get a big income tax return or something they can fix the roof with, but there's always something else.
Nobody ever talks about tax returns on TV, and everybody should, because
your life revolves around that.
We are living off of it right now.
Yeah. If you've got the child tax credit or the earned income tax, I mean, that was when I was a kid, that the year revolved around getting that check.
And the point about Winter's Bone and The Wire, I think those are great examples because they're so memorable because they actually show, like, I remember just like an establishing shot in season one of The Wire where it shows that he has extension cords coming up into this room that he's just squatting in, and like that's something that people have to do, but you've never seen it on TV.
And there's like three kids on that floor.
Yes, and he got up and he made the lunch.
Yeah, and you see that, and it's almost like exotic to see it. It's like, that's not exotic. That's the way millions and millions and millions of people live.
So, I mean, The Wire is one of the great shows of all time, and I know it didn't have great ratings, but it's now widely regarded as like a great masterwork, and you know, Winter's Bone launches one of the great movie stars of the past 5 years, but you never see people do that. It seems like that would be almost like when we talk about Frozen and like how shocking it is to me that there just aren't so many clones out there, like that they're not just like crapping out two princess movies, or at least don't have like five in development. And it's because there's like some resistance there to the idea of showing that, even though it's been really successful in a number of cases, when you just decide to be like really honest about financial consequences or like the consequences of actually having to struggle.
You don't see poor people in comedies unless they're the butt of the joke.
Or unless they just never mention like the crew.
You can't have a poor person just have an adventure but also be poor. Is that right? Can you think of anybody?
Well, like there's lots of shows that are ostensibly about poor people. Like, but that's like that's like the premise of the
like,
right.
You're not going to see that.
Poor, right. Like there's a lot of people that have part-time customer service jobs as their only income, which you're borderline homeless depending on where you live,
right,
if that's all you've got. But they are always in a roommate situation, and then that's it. Like, that's just a launching point for the type of wacky adventures they get into.
Did you see Tammy? I didn't see Tammy, but it sounded like they were working on that, but it was more dramatic than a comedy. Like, she was poor, working class, but it did end up being a comedy, exactly. It was darker.
People found it depressing.
I haven't seen it. Right. But maybe that's why. Maybe people can't handle poverty and laugh.
Yeah.
And just take it in stride. You have to be going through heartaches and overcoming your poverty, or you can't accept it.
But that's surprising, because the background, like the Honeymooners, was they lived in a one-room or two-room apartment, and that was, what was he, a bus driver or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a history there of writers who found just endless things you could explore in poverty, working against the system, the constant setbacks. There's a lot to explore there. There's a lot of comedic situations to explore there. I mean, that's, now granted, like the Honeymooners, all of the comedy came from him like beating his wife, I guess, or threatening to beat his wife. So maybe you couldn't pull that off anymore. But it's crazy to think that there's no, but I think you're right. It may be less that there's no place to go with it, and more that audiences have grown to where they just don't like to see it in the same way they don't like to see ugly people on TV anymore, unless the point is how ugly they are, or if the point is how fat they are. Like the idea of somebody just being like a big, heavy person that's just never mentioned is
right
ludicrous on TV. And maybe that's just, there's certain things we just don't want to see, we don't want in front of us, the way we don't like to see those ads about the dogs they're having to put to put to sleep with that Sarah McLachlan song.
Speak for yourself, I love those ads.
Your article made me think of all the maids and housekeepers and nannies that used to be on TV. Like when I was growing up, all the middle class shows had a live-in housekeeper, as if that were a thing. That's not even, I've never met a live-in housekeeper, ever.
Bob Uecker's this kind of everyman and living in the Midwest in Milwaukee, I think. And they have a live-in, they have a live-in butler somehow. I don't know. I think there's like some elaborate setup for why that happens. And they will correct, like the first season of Saved by the Bell is set in Indiana, and he's like a normal guy who's not that well-liked and doesn't do well in school. And then season two, they move him to California and make him wealthy and give him superpowers. But I think it's kind of this gravitational pull. I'm just trying to get a, like, it's just always going to be easier to do it that way, right? I think especially in comedy, like Roseanne was written extremely well, and they were able to kind of keep things gritty, or like at least set episodes in like realistic situations where like his store closes down or whatever and their daughter runs off and gets married at 18. But Always Sunny is an example where it's like the idea is that they're supposed to be like poor and scrapping and like conning people, but they're like really mean to actual poor people. Oh, yeah. Like homeless people are just like the grossest thing.
No redeeming characters.
Yeah, just like really mean-spirited jokes about actual poor people, which I guess is sort of the thing. And Jason, you pointed out Broad City, which is my favorite show.
Mine too.
But, you know, they are absolutely living beyond their means in a Sex in the City-ish way, almost. The amount of weed they smoke, the temp jobs, like being a temp, you eat ramen and maybe McDonald's.
In the first episode, they are collecting change, right, to go to a concert.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, that is some, but maybe I could see
they
that
address
being,
it, but it's not a persistent set of consequences.
I get the sense that somebody's paying the rent and they're just having their adventures,
right,
and they don't talk about
the fact that they have really
they don't talk about it, but that gets into the same thing that Jack's trying to figure out, is that when you're writing a show, as it goes on and on and on, like you with The Simpsons, like The Simpsons started out being about this working class family, and then by season 6, Homer is an astronaut. And like now, season 20, they've been to like other planets. Bart was like the king of France for a while. So as you go, you run out of ideas. And instead of exploring the characters and their personalities more and more, or exploring like how life, the toll it takes on them, your impulse as a writer is to keep getting bigger and broader and wackier. That requires the characters to have the ability to travel, to buy things, to try wacky schemes like It's Always Sunny gang. They've got a new get-rich-quick scheme every week that they just suddenly have all the things they need. It's assumed, I guess, Frank buys a lot of it, but it doesn't matter. That's the standard setup. When the Simpsons need to go to France, you just show them walking off the plane. And as shows go on longer, they get more outlandish. And with Broad City, this is season 2. So her whole venture is she gets a wisdom tooth taken out. And then while under the influence of the drugs, she gets away and starts, like, she goes on a spending spree. But not only will they never deal with the consequences of that, you know, because I'd estimated she blew something like 100 hours of labor of money. But the cost of getting the wisdom tooth taken out. I know they had Alana's boyfriend do it. Did he do it for free? So that clinic is fine with him. He can do that? Because the copay on my wisdom tooth getting, like, I have insurance through this job, and I still wound up with like $600 out of pocket. If you're working part-time at a gym making, I don't know, whatever she's making on minimum wage
in New York, because it's not minimum wage in Sandpoint, Idaho.
California, I think it's $10 an hour, isn't it?
What? It's a lot of money. But
it would have been when you were making minimum wage. You thought that was what rich people made. But it doesn't matter. Like, you, however you calculate it,
only $8.75.
I was going to say $35. I didn't.
However you calculate it, she lost a couple hundred hours of labor there. Like, that's crushing. Like, I don't care how free-spirited you are, and she's portrayed as, like, the more sensible of the two.
Right.
Like, no, you're not going to have an episode next week where they're going to a Lil Wayne concert. And that's the thing, is even in the best of the best TV shows, nothing you do can create limitations later, because the writers want the freedom to show you doing anything. So all that stuff takes money. And that's the thing. That's the sticker shock when you get out of school, is that living life takes money. All that stuff you all that stuff you think of, like, free spirits doing, like, you know what, I'm just going to go follow this band on tour for a year. It's like, okay, that's attainable. But let me explain, a human still has to eat food, and there's certain things you have to have, and so that money has to come from somewhere. The people you know who did that, they had parents, they had something.
I want to have this exact conversation, but with Robert Evans, because he has had adventures that I don't know how you do. I don't know how he does what he does. He gets on planes and flies.
He eats out of dumpsters. You know that, right?
Is it? Is that how you do it? Because I would do that if it meant I could have those kinds of adventures.
No, you wouldn't.
You're right. But there are people who figure out the lifestyle they want, and they make it happen, and they do it, and it's magic.
I know people, working people with kids, who they will take a vacation every summer. They will go to Disneyland for the kids, because they think that's really important for the kids to see different places. The whole rest of the year, they do not eat out at restaurants.
Right.
They drive cars that are 15 years old, or they share a car. They schedule around it. They work two jobs, and they share a ride. One of them carpools, the other takes the car. They scrimp the rest of the year. They prioritize that, and that's how it works.
There are those people, and then there are other people who just do it anyway. And they take on the debt. I mean, that's the people that we're seeing on these shows do exist in that reality.
If you look at them closely, you will usually find the answer. The answer is usually mom and dad. Now, it doesn't have to be that mom and dad give them money every month. Mm-hmm. But for instance, you know, when I would look around and see, like, the houses people had, a lot of people inherited houses that they were family homes, that they stayed in the family. The mortgage had been paid off 30 years ago, and so you've got this
home. So you don't have a mortgage.
This home that you could sell for $200,000 that they were just granted because the parents went off to live in Florida or whatever, or else they moved into a retirement home, and the home stayed in the family. That's the way it used to be. That's a huge leg up.
Right.
Or their parents put them through college.
Right.
The difference between getting out of college with $100,000 or $150,000 in debt versus getting out of college and being able to start from zero is massive, because you get out into the world with a mortgage, only you don't have a house.
You've got nothing.
You've just got this payment hanging out there that affects everything. It affects your ability to borrow to buy a car, buy a house later on. Like, but that advantage is largely invisible because people don't talk about it.
Right.
And so a lot of the things that you see, like, why don't I have what they had? It's like, you got to understand that having well-to-do parents, those advantages get handed down in a lot of subtle ways that nobody talks about.
What would you say the percentage of people who would have to have, like, crazy wealthy parents on TV versus, like, the reality of people who get out of school and can just, like, you know, do what they want.
It's, it would have to be all of them. Because right. on the It's Always Sunny gang, like, Frank has money through some illegal venture, and he funds, I guess, funds the bar at a loss or whatever. Yeah. Sherlock has to have wealthy parents or something. Like, they've all got to have... Does.
Or no, he has very normal parents. I don't know if they're wealthy.
In the books, I think his parents are an established wealth, because, like, his brother is prominent, too. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's implied that... But that's the point. It's never right. addressed. Like, they don't feel the need to talk about it. It's not a part of his life. And everyone's got this shadow person.
It's like 99% of the people on TV are the 1%, basically. Yeah.
That should be a show, just a show of the people who fund TV adventures.
And I know, like, the Family Guy did a bit about this, where it showed Peter, like, robbing liquor stores or something overnight. To, like, they're asking how he can always afford to fix the house or whatever, and it shows him.
You know who, just as I was reading your article and trying to think of any artist who was, like, better about this than John Hughes, where, like, Ferris Bueller and Cameron both just happened to be extraordinarily wealthy. But I was thinking, like, Eddie Murphy movies, I feel like Beverly Hills Cop, he's always having to trick people. Like, he just, like, cons his way into a mansion by saying he's house sitting there. And when you see his apartment or his friend's apartment back in Detroit, it's like a shitty apartment building that his friend gets murdered in. And then coming to America, like, the scenes in Queens are not a flattering depiction of Queens.
Which is interesting, because Eddie Murphy did not grow up poor. He had well-to-do parents.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I could know that. It's that's one thing that set him apart from somebody like Richard Pryor. But I don't doubt that he knew people. You know, it was important to him to portray it that way, because I think you're right. But I also think the further you go back in cinema history, the easier it is to find more realistic portrayals.
Grittier.
Yeah, it's, and I don't even know that they were being gritty. It's just that there was a time when it was okay. Like, it didn't bum out the audience to show these people living like that. It's, you didn't immediately.
I think there was both, because, like, if you go back to, if you look at movies in the 30s, they went to an even greater extreme than what we see. They went with apartments and houses during the Great Depression that were so opulent that they look like movies.
But they were about people named Daddy Warbucks.
Yes.
Like, it was, yes, like, yes, yes. It was like, but the, I mean, point, like, is, this person's rich. Scarlett O'Hara, she's a wealthy person who lives on a plantation, whereas, like, we have movies or reality shows or TV fictional sitcoms about people who have great places that's not the point. They just happened to.
No, it wasn't the point there either. These were fantasies. These were, like, screwball comedies and romances that incorporated a lot of rich people into the stories, but there were mysteries and there were a lot of movies that just had these fantasy, art deco, beautiful settings, specifically so that when you went to the movies, you could look at something pretty for an hour and a half and then go home to your hovel.
Well, and like Agatha Christie mysteries, they always took place in these... The murder happened in the drawing room.
They're beautiful right. houses.
Yeah, it's always like, you know, which of the servants could have done it? It's like it's like crime is rampant among the elite.
It was probably the gardener and the landscaping's all beautiful, and it's very pretty. So I think it was even more pronounced then. Now they present it as reality, but everybody kind of knew. That's not reality. Nobody knew.
Yeah, I just think that there was more of an awareness that wasn't reality. That back then you had the apartment, where the idea was like, oh, I got this great apartment, and like having a great apartment and knowing how amazing and rare that is sort of a driving element of the movie. And now we have Carrie from Sex and the City, who just happens to live in this enormous... So I have a conspiracy theory of Sex and the City that, and I hope this doesn't sound sexist, but that they just edited out all the parts where those guys paid her and she's just a really high-end prostitute.
That's the worst thing I've ever
because,
heard.
But that's the only way that she could afford all the shit that she has.
Could earn yeah. her or perhaps, living as a writer.
Perhaps, Jack, she has investments she has wisely made with her paycheck.
But the show starts maybe from a place where she's like just getting to New York and she's just scraping by as a writer. She just happens to have the most amazing clothes or rich parents.
Well, they mentioned that she spent $40,000 on shoes at one point.
That's not
like
right.
That's because she had 100 pairs of shoes and they were average $400 a piece. She had so, and they throw that out there as like it was the reason she couldn't afford to buy a house in New York and had to live in that whatever that. How much that apartment cost? $600,000.
Yeah,
yeah. She writes a monthly column in a magazine. So wait, what are they paying her, like $50,000 a column or something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah, per column.
Freelancing.
Yeah, she's doing incredibly well. I'm not buying it. I would, if I were the IRS in the Sex and the City universe, I would start looking into her finances.
Does she have roommates? I've never watched the show.
No, you never watched the show. So of the three people on this podcast right now, you're the one who's never seen Sex and the City.
Which one am I?
Which Sex and the City character are you? Know. The hooker. No, I don't know. I had to watch every single episode of Sex and the City in like 2 weeks for ABC News because they were interviewing someone.
Yeah, that's why I had to watch it too.
It was an interview.
It was for work.
We're married men.
No, but I think it's the same thing earlier. Like when there's a plot about someone who's really fat, they pick somebody who's like 220 pounds.
Yeah.
It, like TV fat or like the ugly girl. What's the movie that just came out called The Duff?
The Duff. It's like, May Whitman. Adorable.
Disgusting, ugly, fat, whatever. And she would have been like the prom queen in my high school. Like she's
absolutely
Like perfect. Yeah. And but like in movie world.
It's the girl from Parenthood.
Yeah. It's the girl from Arrested Development.
In movie
it's
world, they gave her like a hairstyle that's like a little, it's like flat or something. It's like not as, it's like,
she didn't wear her conditioner and now she's ugly.
Yeah, she doesn't.
Dumb, unconditioned fat friend.
Yeah, just.
Is that
horrible,
what that stands for?
Yeah. She's the horrible troll. That's what the entire premise of the movie is.
Designated ugly fat friend.
Yeah. So let's bring up a picture of the designated ugly fat friend there.
Well, her friend has blonde hair, so that makes her look foolish.
She's short.
So like I said, she would have been in the prom court at my... Yeah, there. Yeah, that's her. That's the hideous... Perfect skin, like just absolute, not a flaw on her skin, just perfect ivory, like no...
Jason, she's wearing overalls.
But this is the point.
A confident, adorable girl.
In that world, it's like, I'm trying to think of like the ugliest woman I can. They can only go like this far.
Brunette, 5'2", yeah. and
Wears overalls, yeah. And yeah, maybe throw on some glasses. They couldn't even do that here. Like at some point, they put glasses on her like...
And they're like, oh, Jesus.
No one will watch this. That's too hardcore.
It's funny.
Her teeth are so white.
She's had braces. You know, again. So how does this make you feel about your life when Hollywood's saying this is the dumb, ugly, fat? Dumb isn't the word. It's what's the D?
Designated.
Yeah, ugly. Yeah, she's fat and she has a BMI like under what's considered a healthy weight by doctors. You know, like in the hallway behind her, everyone's like even thinner than that.
Yeah, there's just like guys who are like 6'3". Yeah,
just came from the gym. And so even when they're trying to be gritty, even they're trying to portray something negative, they're so scared you're not going to watch it. So we brought this up on previous episodes, like we're talking with Michael about, like in a movie, you can't help but make everything beautiful. When you're shooting, like he said, even if you're shooting a puddle of vomit, it's still going to be framed up right, lit. It's going to be like the best looking puddle of vomit you've ever seen. Like it's going to...
I respect that.
And so when you have a bunch of people whose job it is to make things look good, they can't help but do it. And even when that thing is poverty, even when that thing is a struggling 20-something, it's still going to look like fun. It's going to look good. It's going to be a good-looking place. The clothes are going to be cool.
What's the movie where Renee Zellweger had to put on Bridget Jones' Diary? In that movie, she's like... 20 pounds lighter than I am right now.
Right, like she assumed a normal weight.
Right.
She assumed a medically healthy weight for a female her age.
Right.
To play...
She's teeny tiny.
To play a hilariously fat person.
Right.
Yeah, like them saying she had to put on weight for that. Eight. She's just making a stupid face, and that's like, yeah, that's what fat people do.
Yeah, she's like leaning down so it gives her like a little bit of a double chin. And that's like, that's as far... And, but then they'll show her like eating ice cream out of it.
That's like an intervention being like, look, you need to eat. We're really worried about you. It's not like a brave weight gain for a movie. And like the Duff thing, like most people have like three pieces of clothes they think like make them look really great. And like when you Google image search the movie, all of the photos, she's wearing the same pair of overalls, the same t-shirt, the three piece of clothing that they could find that made her look bad. They were like...
True. Nobody can pull off overalls. Well, right. I mean, she can.
Right.
They were like...
She's adorable in that.
They had to work their ass off to find these three pieces of clothing, and then they use them in every single shot, because that's as far as they're willing to go, is putting a good-looking person in three pieces of clothing that make them look bad. I think that that's something specific to our culture that we're exporting everywhere in the world, that we only want things to look as good as possible.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything inherent to how humans think about art that say that like everybody has to be good looking and even the mediocre people have to be good looking. Like in paintings, if you want to portray someone as ugly, you make them look ugly. I'd imagine. I've never seen a painting.
And to be clear, she has absolutely played the pretty girl in other movies. Like, it's not like Hollywood only cast her as the Duff or whatever. Like, she's had other roles where she's been an object of desire. It's just it's just arbitrary. It's like, well, yeah, but this one, she's wearing overalls.
Do you guys have anything else you want to talk about? You want to just talk about Vanderpump Rules for a little while, guys?
I've never seen it. I don't know what that is. You keep talking about it like it's a cultural touchstone.
I just learned about it. Well, I started watching Real Housewives because I want to see how real people who are rich have houses and what they look like. And it's crazy. They have, I know it's not real, but they have caterers and
I'm out of things to do with my money. What do these rich people do?
Well, I'm not out of things to do with money. I want to know what it looks like when you are rich. And so I feel like maybe that's how I'll find out.
The guy was being disingenuous when he was like, oh, we don't pay them that much more than you on The Real Housewives. They get $100,000 an episode, I think, The Real Housewives. So, like, in the early seasons when I'm sure they didn't make as much, those women were all, like, being foreclosed on. Their houses were being foreclosed on. But now they, like, have multi-million-dollar paying jobs, so they're, like, in good shape.
But, like, they care about stuff like, I saw an episode yesterday or the other day where she was like, do you see my new place settings? And her daughter's like, oh, beautiful. And I mean, like, she's sincere. She really cares about place settings. Can you imagine caring about place settings?
Oh, Jason is a place settings freak.
And how they set the table and what it, you know, like everything's just beautiful in their house. And that's interesting to me. I know it's fake, but I'm interested in it.
Yeah, but at least you know what you're watching. I mean, show Entourage, that show was lifestyle porn. That's why the show existed. These are rich guys. They don't have serious problems. They've got, like, they all drive. Like, that's the appeal. It's a fantasy, and that's fine. It's just this skews your idea to the point that I think it kind of makes America hate poor people because these movies portray poverty as not being that big of a deal. Rare poor are kind of fun-loving people. They're always trying things. They're always irresponsible. And they're still okay. Like, it's okay for the girls on Broad City, the gang on It's Always Sunny, to be irresponsible, to make gross mistakes, because the next week they're back in the same apartment, mm-hmm. same bar, same clothes, same car. And so it gives the impression of, well, if these people just straighten up their lives, they could live like the rest of us. I've seen, you know, like, you can be a waitress, or maybe you got to get a roommate or something. You know, you'll be fine. It's like, no, that's not, the margin for error is not like that out in the real world. And I think subconsciously, the middle class, the rich, like, I think that's the picture of poverty they have. It's not from The Wire. I think it's from lovable people who work half-assed jobs, who don't really care, don't even really think about money. And that's, they almost choose to be poor because they prefer to be, kind of live loose, you know, goofy.
New Girl is nominally a show about four poor friends. Like, that's the premise. They're like, we have to live together. We're not doing that well. And they live like they're four millionaires. It's like the lifestyle porn is incidental. That's why I think Entourage is the best show on TV.
But I think to say that it doesn't, because everybody knows, well, it's make-believe and we don't want to hear people complaining about their gas bill every month. To act like it doesn't affect your view of the world, I'm sorry. Every single person I know, they've got this upward skewing idea of what their life should look like on their mm-hmm. income. And I think it came from somewhere. And I don't think it's a conspiracy.
That's the American ideal. That's not even entertainment. That's just how we were built. But I think
instead of thinking, I want to be a doctor to have the house and the yard, it's, I want to have the house and yard, and it's just sort of assumed that everybody in America can have that. You know, it used to be the picket fence or whatever, but at least the minimum is house, two cars, me and my wife both, you know, mm-hmm. I'll have a job, she'll have something working part-time, and it's like, no, unless you've got help along the way, it's not going to look like that, unless you live in some very part of the country where it's very low cost of living, but in those parts of the country, there are no jobs. I lived there.
Oh, no, that's not true. You can go, you can live like a king in Texas on a teacher salary. You can buy a mansion.
On a Texas teacher salary?
My in-laws have a beautiful, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, they're both teachers, and they have a gorgeous six-bedroom mini mansion in a beautiful subdivision. It's living in San Antonio. I mean, I love San Antonio, but there are places where you can live very well. That's why I don't live here.
Christy's secretly in the pocket of the San Antonio Tourism Board. So my last question is, so the 70s had this period of like flagrant disco drug use, conspicuous consumption, and then we had like the rocky realism, hard rock thing. Then the 80s were the 80s. It was like, you know, Reaganomics. And then you had the grunge thing that followed that. And then the past 25 years have just been the same. The past 25 years have just been the 80s all the way. Like, we haven't had
we're still in the 80s.
We haven't had a like realism backlash since the mid to late 90s, right? Like Wu-Tang Clan, Nirvana, and Roseanne.
Are we talking about TV shows or movies or both?
Just culture in general. Like, culture went through a period where it acknowledged that poor people exist and that the economy might not be awesome, but then we kind of rocketed off of that into everything being great, and then we had the second to worst financial collapse in the history of the country, and we were still like, woo! Party!
Yeah.
Black Eyed Peas! Like, so much of music now is
party.
It's about partying and, like, not worrying about your problems and, like, almost to a nihilistic degree.
Of all the ways, of all the things you can consume so that you don't have to think.
Like, in the middle of a period where we should be having some sort of reaction.
Reflection on where we are.
No, because from the 80s on, when the industrial base collapsed and we went to an economy that was more like what we have now, where it's based on customer service jobs and debt. What the system needs is consumers.
Right.
This is a consumer-based system now.
So the songs reflect consumerism.
They need us buying things from each other. So again, it's not a conspiracy. There's no, the Illuminati's not like telling their, you know, Lil Wayne, hey, you need to make another song about bling. Like, that's what we, it's just the system has a feedback loop. And from the 80s until now, this is what the system has needed. It's needed us to be buying things from each other to keep this thing going, because we're not manufacturing things here anymore. And
you don't hear rappers singing about
it's a system like, you know, so, you know, the advent of the credit card debt, everybody's got credit card debt now, and just the concept of they need you to keep buying and keep buying into the system. And this is sort of what we've all agreed, this is what humans can do, because the jobs are being done by foreigners and robots. And so in America, I think this thing of making like consumerism king, that's the one thing that you really can't have a backlash against now. You can have a song making, you know, talking about racism, talking about, you know, politics, talking about war. But unless you lash out against consumerism, the problem is if you're a musician who has made a song that's become a big hit about lashing out against consumerism, you probably are now wealthy. So
you can't do it
the
again.
People who are sending us those messages about how you need to live simply or whatever, this is Madonna saying this. Like, you know, the money won't buy you everything. And I know, because I live in a $40 million house. I'm telling you. So there's not really a place for those messages. And for instance, I think religion, like Christianity, used to be very much about material objects are not the point. If you've got too much of something, give it away. Whereas now we've moved more toward the Ayn Rand version of Christianity, where it's about, you know, God wants you to be rich was the name of that best-selling book. And there's all these pastors that are all about, like, look, if you are in God's good graces, he will make you wealthy. This is about worldly wealth. So even there, the message you used to get in your life about, look, that money isn't everything, even that's diluted. Ultimately, everybody has decided, no, you are defined by what you consume, and you need to keep consuming things.
Yeah, I think there's almost the darkest theme that you see, and it's not always self-conscious, but when you mention Lil Wayne, it's like the main thing I know about him other than his really good early mixtapes is that he's crazy addicted to a drug that like has almost killed him multiple times. And when you think about those songs that are popular, the culture acknowledges addiction, and that like that does seem to be like the era that we're in, is that we're just going to keep consuming and that's all we can do, really. Like, that's where we're at.
Those songs are a cry for help.
Yeah, exactly. But like, and everybody on reality TV is like shit-faced the whole time, and
yeah, that makes it more entertaining. That is sad. I did notice that it was very blurred speeches on the show, the Vanderpump Rules episode I saw.
Slurred or?
Slurred. Yeah. But
bleary-eyed. I mean, my face gets blurry when I
blurry eyed, just like, ooh. Yeah. And they're having whole scenes, and with, I imagine, cameras, and you can tell they're really drunk. I mean, they're not actors. These guys couldn't act drunk if
In season one of The Real World, I remember one of the characters, the guy Kevin, was never around because he had stuff to do, like he had to go do a job or something. Uh-huh. And like everyone else just sat around and they were kind of bored. And then season two, there was the guy Judd, who was like a cartoonist and like actually worked, and so you never saw him in the house. And there was a doctor on the show, a female doctor, and he married her because they were the only two people who did anything. And then like MTV figured out like, no, just get alcohol. These just, yeah, just have a full bar and keep feeding them drinks and like get people with drinking problems on the show.
Or if they don't have drinking problems, they will have them because it's free and they have nothing to do.
That's what we've replaced gritty realism with. We still won't pay them, but we'll get them shit-faced.
Thank you, writers' strikes. Yeah. We have a generation of alcoholics.
Well, but they don't acknowledge it. That's the
they
weird
don't.
Thing.
Well, I feel like they...
Jersey Shore did,
obviously. Sometimes they do. It's been a long time since I've seen A Real World. I saw one in Hawaii where the girl just immediately, like the first night they're out, she had to go to the hospital for alcohol poisoning.
And I haven't seen one since that second
season. It's been like 15 years.
but I know one of the characters just died of some manner of drug overdose or drinking or something. So I don't know. It does seem like addiction is going to be an increasingly popular way to cope. So that's a...
If you want to see poverty, you can binge watch Intervention like I do often because you can see
that's
real
almost
houses.
A different type of lifestyle porn, I feel like. It's
so bad.
Duh, gross.
It's so bad. I don't know why I watch it.
Well, same thing with that Hoarders show. Like,
I haven't tried Hoarders.
Seeing how gross these people live is like strangely
I watch
addictive.
Intervention to feel good about myself.
Yeah,
so.
that's why.
I watch Vanderpump Rules to feel bad about myself.
Really?
No.
But they're such awful people.
Yeah, I know. I'm just kidding. I watch both of those shows to feel good about myself.
Correct. Because because the message there is, if you got that wealthy, you would just be terrible anyway. So why bother?
Brand new Beretta. Can't wait to let it go. Walk up in my label like, where the check though? Yeah, I said it. Wouldn't dab you with the left. Shut the text from a centiphobe. I ain't reply. Let him know I read
it. That was our conversation. So one alternate theory that occurred to me while you were listening to it is that in a lot of ways this is similar to the bias you see in movies and TV shows towards white male characters. Like we've talked before about the Bechdel test that basically points out how few movies have two women on screen having a conversation that's not about men that they want to date. And I have continued to be consistently amazed by the lack of greed shown by Hollywood when it comes to cloning Frozen, the most successful movie now ever. And, you know, Hollywood will usually take the success of any little trend that they can jump on and feed it to us until our bodies reject it. Why aren't they being greedy about telling stories with two strong female protagonists? And the obvious answer there is that the majority opinion in an industry can be hard to unseat. Even if most of the studio heads were women, they would have to convince probably a mostly white and male board of directors to make a bunch of movies that appeal to a radically different sensibility than the one that's ruled for so long and the one that they have. And we pointed out that the Sony emails revealed that it's an entrenched sort of piece of accepted wisdom that Denzel Washington can't make movies that are popular overseas because he's black and other countries are racist. Not us, but other countries are. Even though Will Smith had an incredible run of, you know, huge global blockbuster successes. And it seems like that same logic would apply to poverty, right? It makes sense that you wouldn't see a lot of movies and TV shows where characters are worrying about money because those aren't going to resonate with the board of directors either. Those guys want to see Moneyball and The Social Network, and they don't want to see Rocky or Saturday Night Fever. Those have to be huge surprise successes that come out of nowhere and are underfunded. And, you know, I'm using the board of directors as the overarching problem, but I'd imagine that a lot of the other people, most directors, a shocking number of directors are white males. And I bet they, for the most part, don't come from very poverty-stricken beginnings. But I guess none of that would matter if I didn't think that they were crazy wrong to ignore that. Not just because Rocky was a hit and The Wire was great, but, you know, occasionally we'll look at things that have hit really big for our site. And the articles that have really shocked me that were like runaway hits were observational pieces about what it's like to grow up in extreme poverty and what it's like to wear women's clothing, like how annoying women's clothing can be. I didn't see those coming because I didn't grow up in extreme poverty and I rarely wear women's clothing. But those were amazing, huge successes for us. And my sense is that those are both really underserved audiences and we'll continue to see these out of nowhere, incredible hit movies from the perspective of poor people and non-white people and women. All right, on to footnotes. We're going all Drake's new album this week. The new album called, if you're reading this, It's Already Too Late, I believe, because it's just really great. He dropped it a couple weeks ago, and it's the first album in a long time that I've just been like stuck on. I've just listened to it over and over for the past few weeks since it came out. And I'm not sure it thematically fits into this week's episode, other than that he's pissed at his label for not paying him and seems to be making some flagrantly irresponsible financial decisions in the lyrics of the songs, such as I think he mentions a home with a $3 million mortgage and buying a woman an entire mall. But the album has this really consistent feel to it that I love and that I thought was worth playing out across an entire episode of the podcast. If we like the way it comes together, maybe we'll do more one-album episodes in the future. And the songs you heard are Star 67, Energy, and Know Yourself. I'd say Star 67 is probably my favorite song on the album, and it's probably two songs because it kind of just switches up in the middle. Like that one early episode track, House of Balloons, Glass Table Girls, by a fellow Toronto artist, The Weeknd. So yeah, we're going to ride out on that one, and I'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then, guys.
We're sorry. You have reached a number that has been disconnected or is no longer in service.
Yeah. I remember I went to Louis V with half. Watch them spread $10,000 on the glass. I never ever thought I'd see that in my life. Now I'm in the East cause them boys are getting right, man. I was on TV making 50 racks a year. After helping mama out, the shit would disappear. I am not a man, I can't do this on my own. So I started asking them if they would put me on. And they did put me on, yeah. They did put me on. Now we in the basement and we working on the phones. Now we in the basement and we working on the phones, man. Line blowing up. Working on the phones. Now we in the basement and we working on the phones. But I just couldn't do it, had to leave that shit alone, man.
Hear what?
You know,
you're the one. Ah, not
shit. Yo, hear what?
Blowing up, line blowing up, they need a whole thing. Blowing up, my niggas really need a whole thing, yeah, yeah. Blowing up, line blowing up, they need a whole thing. Blowing up, my niggas really need a whole thing, yeah, yeah.
Drake fans who are still listening to this episode should know that this episode was brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn that at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code, how to do graphic design, no matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to Lynda.com/crack today. That's LYNDA.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. So thank Lynda for sponsoring this episode and show your support for this podcast by going to lynda.com/crack today. That's LYNDA.com/crack for a free 10-day trial.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio Boom.com. The wolf dead.